Hello and welcome to Heatwork, a podcast about wood firing and wood fire culture. My name is Mandy and my pronouns are she, they. I'm afraid this is a bittersweet addition to our catalog of episodes. Antra, Corrine, and I recorded this second interview with John Neely about 2 years ago, right after we recorded the first one. As many of you know, John passed away suddenly this past summer, one of those sudden losses that just rips a hole in the fabric of your reality and leaves you reeling from the sudden vacuum and void. Usually when I write these things, I barf words and have to clean up the mess. Words aren't really forthcoming this time, y'all. I really don't know how to put words to this feeling, how to do any justice at all to his memory. It's probably just as well. John was always clever, pithy, and succinct. In honor of his memory, I guess I can at least be succinct. I think he would appreciate that. Other than the typical cleanup, this is the interview as is with very little editing. However, Corrine was having connectivity issues, and where it was especially bad, we did, at the time, re-record some of her questions and observations to splice in later, just for the purpose of listener comprehension. Some of this might be out of context 2 years later, and for those of us who knew him, there are points, hell, just hearing his voice like he's still here and around and reachable, that will very likely make you somewhat emotional, just as a warning in case you don't want to be caught weeping on the bus with strangers. For me, it was when we asked him about retirement and passing the torch, an innocuous question at the time and an extremely piercing one now. I'm inexpressibly glad that we did these interviews with him when we still could. And if I can be a bit bossy, call your mentors, y'all. Tell them how much they mean to you and what they did for you. Do it today. Okay, where should we start? Where did we leave off? What were we doing?
I think that I was looking at all the questions and I want to say that there are a couple of questions. Again, they are either you or Corrine. How much do you keep up with your students over time after they leave USU? Does it depend on the student? Is there a norm or expectation? A wish for more or less contact. Was that you, Mandy?
I think that was actually one of Corrine's questions. Me. Corrine says me in the chat. Oh, for the listener benefit, Corrine's having connectivity issues, so we are translating her questions and comments from chat. She just says me. Corrine is me. So I guess, yeah, John, really that's a question for you is how much contact do you all have from previous students, and does that ever get overwhelming, or is it underwhelming, or is it...
How does one measure that?
If I were to
answer seven, would that make sense?
Seven? There are exactly seven people out of your whole history.
No, I didn't say people. I just said seven. It differs. I mean, I see people on social media and do my best to respond to those things. But you will realize that I'm not very regular about doing that. And I'm always interested to know what people are up to. And yeah, I mean, as much as possible, I like to keep track of what everybody's doing.
Sure. Do you feel like social media is a help or a hindrance?
A help.
You think it helps?
Oh, like, definitely.
Even though it's a slightly less personal in touch.
But it's those students that were here before the advent of social media. There was nothing like that. I mean, it had to be a phone call or a letter or mentioned in a magazine or something like that. And so there's far less of that. And some of those people pop up now on social media also. But those who embarked on all this after the advent of social media are certainly more immediately visible.
Do you ever wish for more personal contact from students, or you like go off being the world?
Well, abstractly, yes. But there are only so many hours in the day. And I can't keep up with everybody all day long, every day. Right. So,
please don't start calling you.
I am able to help people or just, I mean, this seems like most often what I get is some kind of request for a letter of recommendation, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. somebody wants me to look at their kiln plans.
That was directed at Corrine.
She'll say me again. I'm really glad
I'm
going to
send you a heart.
And to the extent that I'm able, I like doing that. And I do feel, I mean, I wouldn't be here without all of you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the excuse for doing all this. So, yeah, I mean, I'm glad to do it to the extent that I'm able.
Thinking about social media, I remember after I met you at Denmark Woodfire Conference, John, I think keeping in touch via Facebook was interesting in the manner that I wasn't sure how much interest do I expect from you, who's not been my teacher at that point. You know, I was still to come here and know this culture and understand and move forward. So it was really interesting for me to see how engaged you were in Facebook.
Yeah, well, surely you realize that I don't really do very much on Facebook. I do it on Instagram and copy it to Facebook.
That's recent. I think that in 2014, I don't know if Instagram had as prevalent.
Instagram was really just getting started around then.
But so it was well underway because I started on both of those things, I think, when I first, well, let's see. It was a couple of years before I took that group to China. And that's 2007. Let's see. The last of the naughties was...
That was
2009, right? And I had gone the year before. So that would have been 2007, 2008. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So 2 years before that, I was in Jingdezhen. That's when I started on Facebook and I think Instagram.
Interesting.
I didn't remember Instagram being that old.
Yeah. And that's because my students there encouraged me to do it.
Right.
I had no idea what it was.
Interestingly, China, I don't know whether people can do social media in China anymore.
Well, but with a VPN, you still can. But VPNs, too, it's kind of like whack-a-mole because they keep blocking them in various ways. But I still keep in touch with various people in China.
I remember when I went to China, it was my first semester at USU, and I went I went for that in Sika symposium that was in Jingdezhen.
Yeah, with Peter Biesecker.
Yeah, well, a lot of people were there. It was a great time.
I mean, that's
what
I set that up.
right. And it was a 3 week long symposium, and the economy collapsed while we were there.
Ah, right.
And I didn't know the economy had collapsed until I got back. I don't know if other people were aware of it and didn't say anything or what. But yeah, I didn't really have an inkling of that until my ride picked me up from the airport and said, oh yeah, the economy went down the shitter. And I was like, oh.
Yeah. Well, it was a progressive thing.
It was a progressive thing and not unexpected, but just the fact that it did in fact happen. And I came back and gas prices were a third of what they'd been. And I said, wow, the world's weird. Okay.
Well, Instagram came to my life only when I came to USU. So maybe it was the other way around that I was only doing Facebook.
Well, things on Facebook, there's too much text, too much rant. And I would rather deal with images and maybe captions.
Yeah.
I found in the last couple of years, I mean, whatever your social media is, it's really how you tailor it, and I've realized that in the last few years. It's like, if people on Facebook are pissing you off, just get them out of your life.
Exactly. I do.
And Facebook has actually become a much more enjoyable thing. I think my generation, a lot of us are still on there because it's the thing we joined and we don't want to join every new thing that comes along. Yeah. But then with Instagram, I really tailored that towards just art and ceramics, made a focal point of that.
Yeah.
And then Facebook is a little more broadly social.
I like that because I do get to keep up with not just former students, but friends and relatives and stuff like that. And so for me, it is unlike those who use it as some kind of PR mechanism. For me, it's more like a diary.
Yeah. Well, when you leave a place, if you say graduate from college and everybody you know, including your closest friends, scattered to the four corners of the world, and you wind up moving somewhere new and focusing where you are locally on the people there, like there's just no way to keep up with everybody.
Right.
Who you care about. And that is a blessing of social media. You do have an, even if you're not talking to them all the time, you do know, you know what's going on with people, and you can reach out. And I don't know. I have a lot of mixed feelings about it, I guess, but it's just appreciating that aspect of it.
Yeah.
That, you know, I don't like the marketing part of it. And the whole influencer thing is
silly,
baffling to me. But
coming back to the connection with students who've moved on from USU, I also feel like, John, you get so many students who've been students to your students.
Yeah,
do you want to speak to that?
The number is increasing. Yeah. Well, it's gratifying that they encourage their students to come here.
Well, I mean, like currently you have Nikita and Caroline there, and they were Ernie's students.
Well, Nikita was.
Nikita Caroline. Was. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought they both were. Yeah. Apologies, Nikita and Caroline.
But I mean, it's still extended influence, kind of. You
right.
Know?
Yeah.
And
Albert, who was my cohort, was Jason Hess's.
Right. And Paige was actually a student with Josh, but under Trevor. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
John, do you follow the work of people whose work you don't necessarily enjoy because they have a major influence, not minor influencers, but major artists?
I don't know. Do I? I enjoy is an odd word. It's work that I think is significant or interesting or somehow compelling isn't necessarily something I enjoy. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I think there are people out there whose work I don't particularly enjoy, but I think is worth following, I guess.
Because they're influential or because it's just interesting?
It's interesting that what they're doing and that they do have some currency. So yeah, that enjoy word is difficult.
Well, in relation to that question of the enjoyment, one thing that I've observed with the Instagram feeds of a few people that I follow, and I don't want too much in my intake, but there are a few people that I pay attention to who seem to have a really polished presentation in sepia tone or just really, really well-managed publicity campaigns. Their work may not be at all interesting, but I find it curious that there is so much public interest for that presentation. Like, it really harkens to nature. It harkens to maybe a time gone by, that as we are in a stage of so much chaos and video games and shiny stuff and maybe people wanting to detach from that, instead they turn to the romanticization of the humble studio potter. And I guess that's what I'm getting at. I'm wondering what you see as some of those trends or reflections to what folk art used to provide as well.
I'm just thinking that this kind of whole, you might call it a hippie aesthetic, that, I mean, that's my generation.
I think there's always, and this is a very general thing to say, but I think there's always going to be romanticization of ceramics. People are always going to be the dreamers of, pottery is earth, is fungus and mold, is so lovely and beautiful. You know, I don't know. Like, there's always going to be people who romanticize it in a way, and then there's always going to be other people who know how to market to that romanticizing. And I think that's what we see with what you're talking about, Corinne, where people just dial into how to present the thing to these people that they know are the dreamers.
And I'm not sure that it's always that conscious. I think the audience is self-selecting, kind of. You get these people that present themselves as super peasants, and they then can capitalize on that image.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and your generation was like the potter in the woods.
Yeah.
That was this weird romantic
the village
idea.
Potter.
The village potter, you know, which is probably never going to exist in a pre-apocalyptic world.
Yeah.
Well, there's also, on the other end of things, people selling this sexy ceramics, people actually using their bodies as part of their whole image as potters. And I do see a lot of that. They bring in this sex appeal to what they're doing. And I'm like, God, I never feel less sexy than when I'm like in the studio, dirty as hell making pots. But they're pulling off that image, I guess, on the social media purposes. But I don't know. I just think that whole thing is weird.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying earlier about using Instagram as a marketing tool as opposed to as a personal diary.
Sure. Yeah.
I think I wanted to ask Corinne's question, which I know on Sunday when we chatted, John, I want to hear John's response again so that we can record it.
See if I'm consistent.
See if you say the same thing.
We'll see. Yeah, that might be the test. We'll see. What do you see as the evolution in the wood fire field? What are its current strengths and deficits, and how do you see those evolving?
Well, at the NCCA in Columbus, Ohio, when I first introduced the train to the NCCA audience, it was a full house and standing room only. No, I mean, they were outside listening. Mm. And I was asked a similar kind of question then about how do I see wood fire? And I said, what I fear is that it will be kind of the flavor of the month, and like raku, will seem dated within 10 years. And I think that has come to pass in certain measure. But like raku, there were people who used raku technique to do something transcendent. Corinne, I can't remember exactly when that was, but it was sometime in the 90s. I should be able to recall it, but I can't. Anyway, there were people, of course, like Paul Solner and Wayne Higby, George Timmick, that were using raku technique to make really significant work. And those who were just making mediocre pots with raku copper penny glaze on them, it looked dated as soon as they started doing it. And looks kind of like varnished bisqueware. And I think that that's true with wood kilns too. I mean, I think there are a lot of people that are making marginal work and leaving it up to the kiln to do something to them without acquiring some kind of control over the results and proceeding with some kind of insight and direction. Now, having said that, the obverse of that is true as well. There are people who are making really good work using wood kilns. And I think there are rather more than I expected. Okay. When I made that comment before, I think there have emerged some really good artists and some really good work that is good in part because it's wood fired.
Yeah. You made a comment earlier when we were talking on Thursday, when we were hashing out whether USU is a quote unquote wood fire program. Yeah. And you argued that it wasn't there, that it's that the kilns are tools.
Yeah.
And like any tool, the user is what makes something out of it.
Yeah.
You can have the most state of the art tool. If you don't actually know how to use it, then you're not going to make anything of any quality with it.
Yeah. Or any significance. Yeah.
Which is why I never bought one of those fancy Nikon cameras. Like all of that, all of those whistles and bells were going to be lost on me. It sounds like that's what you're saying. It is a tool that you can build and you can use. But if you don't know what you're doing and you don't know what you're doing with the work that you put into it, the kiln is not going to do that work for you in terms of quality.
Right. I think, too, something that has becomes increasingly apparent is that wood as a fuel is one way to harvest solar energy to the extent that we don't rely on petroleum. It has legs. It has a future. I think this whole environmental thing is a big issue for potters because we do use, you know, a lot of energy and we need to be cognizant of using it well. And so valuable resources expended in less than meaningful ways is a shame. So if people can somehow lessen the impact, I think that's a good thing.
How would you tie that notion, like, okay, you need to use it well and use it efficiently because we are dealing with the climate change world. How would you tie that back into the, what was the quote, the mistakes quote?
The mistakes quote?
You can make good decisions.
Oh, good judgment comes from experience and experience comes from bad judgment.
Right. What I'm wondering is where does, because people learning how to wood fire are going to make a lot of mistakes and do it badly until they learn to not do it badly, because there is a fairly steep learning curve that goes with it, with understanding it. So like, is it responsible? I'm sorry, this question keeps spiraling into something bigger. There's a lot more wood kilns now than there used to be. There was a comment you made about that. You can't swing a cat these days without hitting a wood kiln. And so, and inevitably, there are going to be people using them better and some people not using them better. Is it responsible ecologically, I guess, to have this many wood kilns and be on that learning curve with all the mistakes?
Better wood kilns, I think, than petroleum-fired kilns, like gas and oil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is still room for fry oil kilns, but that got a rise out of Corrine.
Again, pointed at Corrine.
But I think that comes from peanuts and sunflowers and that sort of thing, which is a renewable resource. It's harvesting solar energy, which is, I think, a more responsible way to go about it than fracking.
Right.
So I'm going to throw this in there. So I recently had a really lovely studio sale and really nice fellow came to visit and he said, oh yeah, I used to make pots in high school. And he was telling me this little story that he basically started to realize that his work was so underwhelming that it wasn't worth the energy, like the BTUs that it took to complete it, and that he was just making more stuff and it wasn't all that good of stuff. And so he moved on to farming. But the point here being that I looked at him and said, I really understand that because I have some of those same internal debates about the value of whatever work that I'm presenting to the world. And just kind of curious where a maker lands with that judgment call, because it's a tough one to make sometimes, especially as the world changes. And as I was talking about this a little bit with my farmer friend, I watched his face fall, because he loves my work and sees it as valuable enough to expend those BTUs. So it's just an interesting contrast between the two perceptions there.
I mean,
yep. Not even really a question, but
I mean, it leads to a certain kind of paralysis.
My energy. I'm going to rebuild my wood kiln. I'm not paralyzed by that.
I said it before, but those who have actually expended the energy to wood fire, the reliance on trucks and chainsaws notwithstanding, they have a better understanding of the stakes. And they, as a group, I think, are probably more aware than those who are baking pots in electric kilns.
Hey, this is Corrine. Welcome to the mid-roll. Just wanted to extend my most heartfelt condolences to Atsuko and Erica and all my dear friends and all the extended family and the students. And I know we're all hurting and appreciative of John. Hope y'all are well and remembering all the good times. In the midst of a writing project, I have been listening to George Saunders' book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, which lovingly analyzes short stories from pre-communist Russia. Think Chekhov and Tolstoy. I say lovingly because I think love is the basis of constructive critique. And man, does he get down to brass tacks. He's a writing teacher at Syracuse, which is apparently a writing equivalent to the ceramics program at USU Logan. You know how we get these gravitational centers of a certain focus of knowledge. So I'm listening to this teacher giving me the most helpful analysis of a dense bite of a time and a place, and I just can't not think about how critique with John was like that. So unbelievably helpful in its pithy perception. You don't manage that without sitting on a library of curiosity, and you can't deliver it without love. My favorite critique from John was in the form of a cartoon. I was making pictures, and to have the vertical volume and weight so high above the tiny foot that I insisted on at the time rendered the whole thing so unstable as to be practically useless. My handles were upside down because I found them more comfortable that way. He printed out a copy of Popeye strutting out, a giant shoe, a straight leg strutting out proudly. The shoe was twice the size of his head, which was cast far backwards. All the action was off balance, but also made a successful exaggerated impression in the cartoon. What John was trying to show me was that in the low balance point of the handle and shoe, there was a low thrust to the psychological weight of the pitcher. But because the pitcher is essentially a vertical form, the balance point is very uncomfortable on such a small foot. He wasn't telling me that it was good or bad as such. He was just illustrating to me how it was working. As chance would have it, I was so enamored with the painterly results of the wood firing that had finished it that I submitted it to some show at the Eccles Museum and some visitor knocked it off the pedestal. I had noted its value at $150, so that's what I got in a check one day. It was a picture enough out of balance as to be subject to diminished attention. But who doesn't love Popeye? John could perceive and analyze qualities of an object the way George Saunders analyzes iconic short stories, with a precision that truly helps the students see how exactly to move forward with their craft. For John to have become a teacher was a gift to the world. I had a dream of him recently. I had been pruning the orchard, and one of the Japanese plum trees was so heavy that its branches were weeping. He said, "Hey, you're doing great. Let me know when they're almost ripe, and I'll come over, and we can make umeboshi." And then he came over, but noted that actually, even though my tree was a cultivar of plum that the nursery had told me that was used to make umeboshi, John said, "Umeboshi is traditionally made with a totally different kind of fruit from a family, much more like an apricot." And I said, "Yes, yes, I know. That's the other tree. But it's a year younger and much less vigorous, and it only gave me two fruits this year." So, I hear you, all you students out there who are frustrated and grateful to have been in critique with him. I'll send you some proper umeboshi in a few years. Send me your number. I'm not kidding. Love you lots.
Like, I feel like with the energy perspective, and I'm not trying to give anybody an out for trying to live as responsibly and, you know, work as responsibly as we can. But I think about the wood we burn in a wood kiln, even in an onagama, which upwards of 15 cords of wood per pot, per firing.
Not per pot.
Well, I would say a pop, P-O-P. Yeah. But people worrying about that carbon footprint. And then you look at the forest fires that are happening every year. And like, how many kilns worth of forest fires are going up every year, and realizing that what we do isn't a drop in the ocean of the problem, the energy problem. I know, Corrine, you and I have talked about this a couple of times, the statistic that 95% of the climate change pollution that's causing the problem is 50 corporations.
Yeah.
It's happening at a level that is so far above us as the individual consumers. And while conglomerate consumerism can have an impact on that, I feel a little staggered with the task of even trying to make a difference. or trying to affect a difference in my individual practice.
You've also talked about the carbon footprint of Fritz.
Yep.
Yeah, with any synthetic material, which seems to be becoming more common with the supply chain problem.
Well, but still the supply chain, how efficient is it for us to be using feldspar from North Carolina or kaolin from England? That gets into the local material thing, that is another kind of thread.
Yeah, can of worms, right? Well, I mean, we were talking earlier about the spodumene shortage, you know, and now Bailey has synthesized a spodumene, and it's like, well, what's the footprint of that synthesis, and do we now have to factor that into everything? And it's still, you have to get it from Bailey, which is, where is Bailey?
Pennsylvania or something.
Pennsylvania, like. Yeah. Still, you have to get it from all the way across the country if you're where we are, you know, so it's still as irresponsible, if not more so.
But part of the point is that the moral quandary of what it takes an artist to expend in terms of their carbon footprint is, it seems like what art can contribute to culture is worth it.
And yeah, I think so too. But I mean, just being aware makes a difference. I mean, I keep coming back to that same E.F. Schumacher line about think globally, act locally. Mm. So we do what we can at the scale that we can manage, but we do it with the awareness of the rest of the earth.
Yeah, I think that going back to what Mandy was saying about carbon footprint as compared to 50 corporations or something like that, I think even if it is just 1%, if we are using wood instead of fossil fuels, we are using renewable energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and a lot of people pay attention to how they source their wood. The way of USU was going to the dump, getting the wood that was already there in the dump, trees that had already been cut down. You know, Corrine is trying to get her forest healthy again, which means thinning it out, which means cutting down a lot of trees, you know, on her land, but it's trees that need to come down. Or, you know, Pleasant Hill has relationships with mills that work with hardwood, and they're just giving them all of their offcuts, and they would be processing that wood anyway, so that we're just processing the waste product. Corrine, didn't you have a solar-powered electric kiln?
What?
Did you do that, or was that like a dream you had?
It's a dream you had.
That's a dream I had. Okay. I thought you had tried to do a renewable electric kiln setup in the barn there, but sorry.
No. There are solar panels on my barn.
There's not enough energy there provided by the solar panels to account for everybody's electrical needs.
But it's not direct like that. It services the entire property.
Okay. So I didn't entirely make that up, but
honestly. You didn't entirely make it up, but there are these super cool like solar powered ovens that are dish shaped, and that is a total tangent.
Okay.
I know there are some potters in Australia who are working with electric kilns that is solar powered.
Okay.
And I'm forgetting where I was having this conversation, but if their solar panels are not generating enough power to complete a cone gen firing, the grid system from where they get electric power to run their place also is solar powered.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think that there is a possibility in that direction.
Right. The last house we lived in had solar panels, and it was interesting because we didn't have an electric bill because the solar panels were enough to supply the house and to feed the grid. Like all the excess would go off to feed the grid, and then our landlords would get this rebate for that. That was really nifty. So I guess I technically had a solar powered kiln, but it wasn't like a direct thing. It was just for the house.
Yeah, we have solar panels above our roof, but we don't produce as much in the winter.
Well, that's another interesting thing with the environment in Logan is the inversion problem in the winter time tends to get in the way of wood firing, doesn't it? I mean, sometimes
certainly does. Yeah,
down. Yeah, for the listeners, inversion is where the colder air gets trapped under the warmer air above in a valley. And then because Logan is in a valley, it's all city, it gets polluted. So the air gets very nasty in the wintertime sometimes.
So we don't fire.
So you don't fire. And that wrecks some student plans sometimes, doesn't it?
Yes. It's really hard if you're counting on wood firing for your thesis show, which happens in the spring.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm thinking of Robin DuPont was there when I was there, and he wound up soda firing his thesis work because he couldn't rely on being able to.
Some of it, yeah.
In my time, there have been a couple of students who waited a weekend to fire. And then there was a conversation with Josh Kunsting, who remembers counting over 40 days after a loaded kiln to actually fire.
Oh my gosh.
So.
Well, and that's got to be a scheduling nightmare because you sign up for one wood kiln and somebody else is trying to come in after you.
Yeah.
Have to wait. Oh my God. Is that why so many people move away from wood firing while they're there, John?
Could be.
Well, 2 out of 3 right here.
Well, I didn't even come in doing wood firing. I mean, I dabbled in it the first year I was there, but I pretty much stuck with gas firing.
To the point that not all students are there for wood firing and the school is not necessarily pushing wood firing, I think that one of the things that I got the most out of from my time there at school was just a really open-ended critique mode where the work could go in any number of different directions. And so, for example, one student mentioned that my work was so form-oriented, like it was just not standard forms. And so it was so design-oriented that maybe just simple white glaze would show it off even better than wood firing, because I was hell-bent on wood firing. But through critique, I started to see, and at first I was like offended probably, but you know, he was right. And I thought that sort of thing was really interesting. And eventually I got less hell-bent on wood firing in my time there and did gas-fired reduction cool, which I think was a more gentle way of showing off the form while still creating some of the not atmospheric effect, some of the color that I was going for. So that's just an intriguing element of open-mindedness around what a school's agenda may or may not be. And I appreciated the support that I had in that space.
Good.
So what is your agenda, John, at school?
Well, I've said it before, you give people the tools to do what they want to do and then get out of their way.
Sometimes you have to drag them into figuring out what they want to do.
Well, that I have a hard time doing.
There was another thing you'd said, John, that it's not to please you or Dan, but to really find themselves through their work.
Yeah.
Were those your words or did you say it a different way?
Well, something to that effect, yes.
Why don't you say it, please?
I don't know for sure what I said.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, you said that the students who are there to try to impress you and Dan are not going to succeed at impressing you and Dan.
Right.
That if that's the motivation, then...
I may have also said that.
Sorry. Not to put words in your mouth. I'm trying to remember.
You know, from day to day, I don't always say the same thing. What's that line about... consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds.
Hey, I'll come back to another legacy question. What form have you observed your own legacies taking in the students and careers you've watched mature after receiving your mentorship?
I don't know. I mean, I see people out there making stuff still. And so that, I guess, is my legacy, is that I've given some people the tools to continue.
Are you pleased with the legacy of your students?
Yeah. And I mean, I said it before that just the fact that there's such a number still in there pitching, I find gratifying. I have to say, though, that the percentages are much greater for the MFA students than for the BFA students. And I think that that's because before coming to grad school, you all have self-selected. I mean, those who didn't elect to go to grad school have already made some other kinds of decisions. So numbers-wise, there are more of the MFAs that are still in the game.
Do you think, because the BFA program is a decently rigorous one in terms of the intensity of learning
yeah.
that they go through is possibly a little more than other programs are. Do you think they get a little spoiled at USU and then don't want to go anywhere else?
Well, I think there are probably some who see it that way, but.
And I mean, spoiled just because it's such a great place, not because USU spoils people.
No. Not like rotten fruit, huh?
But I mean, like, they graduate from USU and they're trying to look at grad programs and they're hard put to find somewhere that's better, I guess is what I meant by that.
No, I don't think that's necessarily true, but I think it's just the nature of undergraduate education that people aren't as committed. And most of the people who come into grad school aren't coming right out of undergrad. I mean, there are only a couple of examples of people who came directly out of undergraduate programs.
Do you think, is that a good move on the part of somebody going into a grad program?
To Absolutely. I think
not come straight out of
I think grad? That before somebody commits to going to grad school, they ought to get some mileage.
Yeah. Mileage and outside of school life experience. Yeah. Do you see a lot of burnout with people who try to come in straight from undergrad?
No, not really, because we just don't take them very much. But yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, it's not like I've done any kind of statistical analysis of it, but there are always people applying, but we don't end up taking them. And then they disappear. I mean, I don't hear any more from them. So whereas there are some other people that we have not been able to take whose careers I continue to follow. And, you know, it's always there's a measure of regret that I was unable to work with them.
I'm curious who those people may be. Maybe this is not the place to name names, but I'm curious all the same.
Yeah, there are a number of them.
The chips fall where they may.
Yeah, I was going to say there's compatible personalities and then there's incompatible personalities, and it's not even a measure of character.
No,
I mean, but it's just you can't work with everybody.
Well, you can't take, yeah, but not because of ability, but rather because we're only taking two people a year. And
right,
you know, and someplace you got to make a judgment call, and that's the way it works out, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was living in Minnesota and thinking about grad schools, I was looking at the U of M there. And it's intriguing to think about how my life might have gone in a different direction by working with Mark Ferris. And, you know, because of his interest in CAD, how that might have changed things for me. Now that I'm ever so vaguely working with CAD myself, it's just kind of fascinating to ponder.
Yep.
Well, I did CAD here at USU.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering when you came to USU if that was a possibility or not.
It was a possibility, but not one that was readily pursued. For one, we had a couple CAD programs on the computer lab machines. I mean, we paid for site licenses for those things, but we didn't have CAM capabilities. We could do design, but not manufacturing. We couldn't, you know, we didn't have printers or milling machines or anything like that. All we could do was basically do computer-aided drawings. Yeah.
Do you all have ceramic 3D printers now?
Nope.
No.
Okay. Out of choice or because they're too expensive or?
No, because there's no room.
I just wondered what the attitude was towards that. Is it another potential tool that could be used?
Absolutely, it is. But it's an emerging technology, and it's really interesting to me to see what people are doing with it. With the stuff that Eva Kwong is doing right now, I'm really intrigued by.
Well, we've been picking John's brain for an hour now.
Yep.
And I think that I've been looking at the questions, and I think that we've asked all the questions that I... Or we've touched upon those topics, so...
Okay.
Is there anything
Can I do one parting question?
I bet you can.
I'm gonna. This has to do with what happens after when you and Dan retire, and you're going to pass the torch at some point on this program that you've really shaped for over 30 years, and given what's happening in some places like West Virginia, programs being shut down. What are your hopes for when that torch passes, and do you have any worries or any concerns?
Well, I guess I have worries, but I also think that at one level, I've made my effort and it will evolve in its own way. And if I can be of use to someone coming in, I'll gladly be, you know, help. But I think that I also shouldn't try and manipulate the outcomes. I mean, I've had my go at it. Now it's time to let somebody else have a go at it.
I guess I wonder how it feels, what your feeling is on the prospect of handing over this baby of a program.
more than that, I mean, look at my office and all the books in it, and look at my studio and all the stuff that's in that. What the hell am I going to do with that stuff?
Burn them. Just burn them.
Dump it on the incoming person. Be like, here you go.
Yeah, well, so at one level, I want to use all that stuff still. I still refer to books and yeah, but I don't have room for it at home. Mm-hmm. I'm sure as hell not going to take it all to Japan. So yeah, I don't know. Inertia sets in and it's, you know, it's hard to overcome.
Well, I want to quickly change topics, and we said only one last question, but
we're going to do this 10 times.
Yeah. I think the question that I skipped was, what were the better parts of the legacy that you inherited, John?
Well, I'm not sure what the legacy I inherited is. So it's hard for me to identify, let alone discriminate between the good and the bad. I am the sum total of my influences. And, you know, there are a bunch of those influences, and I hope that I do them justice.
You talked a little bit about some mentors you had had, and many of them were not necessarily clay people.
Right.
In fact, most of them, the ones that you mentioned, weren't. But can you articulate about any or all of them? What made them special as influences?
Each one is different. I mean, they're so different. They brought different things to me, and I learned different things from them. So it's impossible to generalize.
Sure.
You know, can you sort out the differences between Dan Hammett and John Neely?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're two very different men. I mean,
I realize, I know that, but still, you, in some measure, have absorbed stuff from both of us.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, and like you said, I hope that I perpetuate the positive influences.
Good stuff.
I think we all hope that we took what was good from our mentors and have a way to pass that on. But I mean, like Dan Hammett, he kind of scraped me off the pavement after I came out of a very bad mentorship situation in theater. I was just about as low as self-esteem as I could be at that point. And he kind of dusted me off, stood me up, and was like, okay, what can we do with you? It's wild to have somebody believe in you when you've had an experience where people didn't. His attention to people who gave a shit was staggering. And all you had to do is care a little bit, and he'd just bend over backwards and do anything for you.
Yeah.
And that's something that I took away from that whole relationship, was just, if people need help and they just care a smidge, you know, just what can you do for them and how much can you do for them? Because he did so much. What I said about you before, your attention to individual personalities is sometimes subtle. It's not always obvious that that's what you're doing, but you do read people and you read what they need.
And then you
reach them, you know. And I mean, you know, we've watched a lot of people struggling with motivation during my time there, and I wasn't necessarily privy to conversations you had with them, but you and Dan, you know, respectively, always seem to be assessing people where they are and on the level that they're at, and trying to figure out how to elevate them and how to push them up to this level that they need to get to. And again, that's this gargantuan amount of effort to do that on the individual level with how many students you have. And again, something that I aspire to. I hope, I don't teach at the scale that you all do, but I hope to be able to do that for people, to figure out where the problems are and then to start untangling them. Like, I feel like that's what you all do. You untangle people's issues.
But I think you said it right. You start to untangle.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, sorry, I went off on a tangent there, but you asked.
Well, but I mean, just thinking about Dan, I mean, I met Dan in 1970, either 71 or 72.
At Alfred, right?
No, no, at Kansas University before he went to Alfred. Okay. And I also ended up going to Alfred, but we exchanged emails not too long ago, Dan saying, you know, we've known each other for more than 50 years now.
And you said, stop that.
Yeah, he had started in on an MFA at KU, mm-hmm. where I did my freshman and sophomore years at Kansas University. And he left the program there to go to Alfred.
And it was Val Cushing's program at the time.
Well, it was Val and Ted Randall and Bob Turner. And so we had the same teachers when we were there. But I transferred that next year to Alfred and then went to Japan instead. Right. And so I was getting credit from Alfred while I was in Japan, but I only went back to be in residence my senior year. And Dan was still there as a grad student.
Were you all friends or did you not get along?
Oh, yeah, no, we got along fine.
I'm just curious because he has one of those kind of abrasive personalities that you're either.
He really never seemed abrasive to me.
Okay. People either really got along with him or really didn't. It was interesting to see how different people.
Yeah.
And you're talking about Dan, your mentor, Mandy.
Yeah, Dan Hammett. Yeah, not Dan Murphy. Dan Murphy was also a mentor and took things from him too. But so many Dans in the world.
That makes me feel like talking about when we talked about potlucks at John's place and we talked about how amazing the experiences are, the different aspects of learning. I feel like the amount of attention that's paid onto when a choice of a ceramic dish is made to present a certain kind of food on it and taking time and putting in the energy to make that happen. And that would happen at John and Atsuko's home. Mm-hmm. So I think that was really special and continues to be because I continue to live here.
But that's another thing where it's better demonstrated than it is talked about.
Yes,
it is. But I there was a big, huge takeaway from USU, and it was the relationship of food and community around and how integral the pottery was to that. It was a very intimate relationship. And you just said, no, it's better demonstrated than talked about. And it was absolutely over and over again demonstrated the importance of that relationship.
Gets into the experience in all senses. And maybe Mandy, Corrine, and I could have actually notes of, did John make waffles at the end of the semester?
Did you make waffles? I don't remember you making waffles.
Well,
when did you start doing that, John?
Well, I've done it off and on, but...
Ice creams. They're all the ice creams and then the liqueurs that you made. Yeah.
Yeah. The waffle thing became more important because Lewis Riley...
I remember Lewis.
We had a beginning of the year meeting. And there was a holiday on the Monday that we were supposed to meet with the grads. So I said, come over to the house for breakfast and I'll make waffles. Well, he got it into his head that that was a yearly thing. And so he was expecting that the next year. And after he finished, he was expecting, you know, he told other people that this was a year.
Uh-huh. So now you have been roped into. I do remember that. It was Labor Day or something.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, it was Labor Day. I do remember that. We did come over and make waffles. I forgot all about that.
I know I had made waffles for people before that, but that's when it became a more regular thing.
Yeah, that's funny that he made you, forced you into a tradition.
Yeah.
I kind of have some mad props and respect for that, honestly.
I'll say this about waffles, though, that you have to make a certain quantity to make it work. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work with just two people. We never, but never make waffles.
Yeah. Well, no, because you have to make a big bowl of batter to make it worth it. And you just crank pouring and cranking them out.
And in among the zillions of books that John has, it's not only ceramics. I have a book on composting, a book on baking, and a book on basin and ranges, which is geological formations in Utah at this moment. borrowed from John.
Oh, yeah. The books from John were awesome. When you found out I was going to China, I came in the next day and there was a whole stack of books on my table. And none of them were ceramic books. They were, you got me into Peter Hessler's writing because he had a lot of, I don't know what you call that, narrative nonfiction, I suppose, yep. about his time there and reflections. And yeah, actually, he would write about the, I might be about to pronounce this wrong, the Uyghur population.
Uyghurs, yes.
Yeah, which has, and they've been in the news, unfortunately. They've been in the news quite a bit.
It's only gotten worse.
Yeah. But yeah, that was an early, when I saw that, the Uyghur come up in the news, and I was like, oh my God, I actually know what
he's talking about.
Yeah. And then, I don't know, there was the one about the young punk kid who decided he was going to be a Shaolin monk and just went to China and found them, there were just wild reads, but they were good. I don't know how practical the information was.
But... No, but I hope anyway that it gave you some insight into contemporary China in a way that, your typical tourist book doesn't.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is going to sound awful. It was a lot of non-propaganda points of view too. If you go to China, that can actually be kind of hard to come by in a lot of regards. If you're doing an official tour, you aren't going to get a government approved version of everything, where they disregard things like Tiananmen Square and things like that. And so it was a really healthy stack of books that gave, I'm not going to say it's an unbiased perspective, but it was a very honest perspective.
Yeah. Well, I hope it was an unbiased.
Well, I don't know that anybody writing narrative nonfiction is totally unbiased. I don't know if that's possible, but that's probably a philosophical topic.
Well, that particular category has only continued to grow. So I have more and more. I'm looking up at the shelf right now.
Yeah.
Ones that have come out since you were here.
You gave me one. It was the Hessler books. It was the Oracle Bones.
Yeah.
And then there was one where he went on a road trip all over China. And I don't remember what that one was called, but it was also very good. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I can't think of the title.
I think I did the same thing when I was...
Went to Japan.
Well, Japan and also Thailand. So there was a Thai author analyzing Japan. I'm going to sign off. I'm getting a little cold.
I'm ready to go home.
Present.
And... Yeah.
Make a sandwich.
Wow. John, but you haven't had dinner yet? Been... I'm sorry.
No, I was at a funeral.
Right. That's right.
Oh, I know.
For you. Well, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good to see y'all.
It's good to see you too.
I so appreciate you in my life, John. I was thinking earlier as Mandy was talking about her experiences with Dan Hammett. It's just amazing to me how there are subtle things and more obvious things that push a person in a particular direction. And I have some lovely people in my life, but certainly you've been a great presence.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks again, John.
So I'll sign off.
Thank you to Julie from Elaborate Flight of Fancy for our logo, and to Joshua Clausen for our music. You can find them both on Facebook, and Joshua is also on SoundCloud. This is the last episode we recorded 2 years ago. I'm keeping this little project open-ended, but I'm not sure if or when we'll put out another episode. For now, it's a 7-episode podcast miniseries. Thank you to Corrine, Alex, Aubrey, Antra, and Tara for embarking on this with me. I like to think we've contributed to the woodfire culture with this little podcast. I want to echo Corrine in sending my heart out to Otsko, Erica, Dan, Antra, Todd, and all the other colleagues and students who were used to seeing John and getting to talk to him every day. Also, I send it out further to my fellow compatriots, the last of the Naughties, and all the other students, friends, family, and others who had the good fortune to be in John's orbit at one time or another. In the week following his death, I had the dichotomous joy of the loveliest conversations with so many people I love and don't get to talk to every day. Thank you, Denny, for being awake so late the night that he passed and spending time both talking and silencing with me. Thank you, CJ, and Bobby, and Alex, and Corrine, and Tony, and Dan, and Heidi. Thank you, Corrine, for sitting with me now while we record these last bookend snippets. Hearing your voices that night and the next day was so grounding, and it was a reassurance about John himself. We are his legacy, and I so look forward to perpetuating it with all of you. Bang on. You're doing it.